You're listening to episode 17 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this interview, we talk with industry veteran Ryan Dancing. Running time for this interview is 54 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
My name is John.
My name is Chris.
And joining us today is Ryan Dancy.
Hello.
Those of you who have been with us from the beginning will know who Ryan is. Those of you who don't, we will let him give a resume here in one sec. But before we do, I just want to remind you guys that John's Kickstarter for Blood Moon Goblins is still out there and running.
That is correct. It launched 2 days ago, and as of this recording, is almost halfway there. So
nice.
It has taken off like gangbusters.
Congratulations on that, by the way.
Thank you. Yes, I sold my first goblin today and several advanced copies of the prints and the PDFs.
Yeah,
so if you want to get them, buy them ahead of time. And if you want some crazy reward, they are on there.
Yeah, so don't hesitate to get out there.
Even if you can't support it, just go watch the video. Just seeing it for Fat Dan is enough alone. So
yes, the video actually might wind up to be like funnier than the game.
But
so it's worth it.
The one thing I did want to add was there were some people in other countries, like in, well, Europe, which is a continent, obviously not a country, who were hesitating to go after some of the higher items because they said, well, John's probably not going to do a huge time zone jump to GM for us.
Oh, no, he is.
Yeah, that is not the case. If you get those items and you live in Australia or Europe or Asia or whatever, John will stay up for your time zone and run a game for your group.
That is correct.
Do not hesitate to go after those line items.
I am seeking employment and I am awake until 4 a.m. anyway. So if you are a Euro gamer, an Aussie gamer, or a Kyrgyzstan gamer and you want the big ticket item, please fire away.
All righty, so let's get to the guest we have joining us. Ryan, you want to go ahead and give a quick resume, sort of refresher for the people that heard you the first time around, and perhaps an introduction to anyone who's hearing your name for the first time.
Sure. I got my start in hobby gaming in the early 1990s. I operated a mail order business called RPG International, like at the very birth of the internet. We actually have a letter from our bank telling us that if we accepted credit card payments over the internet, they would close our merchant account because the internet was fundamentally insecure and could never be used for commerce.
Well, they had one thing, right?
Insecure is the people on the internet.
Yeah, exactly. And as a part of running that business, I got involved with the guys at AEG, and we created a joint venture to develop and publish the Legend of the Five Rings trading card game. When the joint venture became successful, we spun that out into a standalone company called Five Rings Publishing Group. And in 1997, as a part of running that business, we became involved with TSR as they started to head towards a bankruptcy filing. We were able to create the conditions that allowed Wizards of the Coast to buy TSR. And as a part of that transaction, they acquired our company as well. And I went to work at Wizards. And I was there from 1997 until the very early part of 2001. And when I was at Wizards, I worked in a group called New Brand Development and Licensing. We were responsible for developing all of the non-Magic trading card game properties at Wizards. And I worked with the team that identified and licensed Pokemon as the new game for the company to be promoting in a big way.
I had a killer Hitman Chan deck. That was a fun game.
It was a fun game. And right after that decision was made to license that game, Peter Ackeson, who is the CEO of Wizards, came to me and asked me if I would be interested in trying to take over and fix the role-playing game business that they had acquired from TSR. And I was very much interested in doing that. I've been playing Dungeons & Dragons since I was about 12 years old, and it's something I've done my whole life. And I was very fortunate. I worked with a very talented and diverse team of people at Wizards, both in the brand and business management group and in the R&D side. And we were able to identify a lot of the problems that the business had kind of grown up to and inherited over the years. And we were able to do some innovative things when it came to producing a new version of D&D, which was the third edition. And one of those innovative things was the idea of licensing the world to use the mechanics that are inside Dungeons & Dragons for free, kind of an open source software approach applied to gaming. We called that the Open Gaming License. And I was responsible for pushing that project through the bureaucracy and getting the permission to release the license, the contents of the Player's Handbook, Dungeon Master's Guide, and Monster Manual, and a trademark license so that people could show they were using the same rules that D&D was using. We had a thing called the D20 System Trademark License that let you put the D20 System Trademark logo on your products, and it was the same logo that was on our products. So there was a great way for consumers to know they were the same. I left Wizards in 2001. I started a company called Organized Play, and Organized Play was a software services company that was designed to let small game publishers get access to the same kind of technology for running organized events for role-playing games and trading card games that Wizards of the Coast had. And the idea was that we would incubate in the hobby game industry for 1 to 2 years, get the technology to the point where it was secure and scalable and could do all the things we needed it to do, and then try and take it into the computer gaming business and bring those same lessons that Wizards learned about how getting people to play with ratings and rankings and on an organized schedule really improves the ability of the game to attract and hold players over the long term. Unfortunately, that business didn't work out, and by the middle of the 2000s, I had shut organized play down. I was running a consultancy with my friend Luke Peterschmidt, who was also a brand manager at Wizards of the Coast. And we were working in Las Vegas at the time with a third friend of ours, Christian Moore, who used to run Last Unicorn Games, publishers of Aria, Canticle of the Monomyth, and the developers of the Dune trading card game for Five Rings Publishing. And I got a phone call from a headhunter asking if I would be interested in a job in Reykjavik, Iceland. Apparently, I was one of the only people that headhunter talked to who said yes. And I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to join CCP, the company that had purchased White Wolf about a year and a half earlier. And CCP has offices in Reykjavik, Atlanta, and Shanghai. Its flagship product is a science fiction MMO, massively multiplayer online game called Eve. And after buying or merging with White Wolf, their next large project is scheduled to be the World of Darkness MMO. I lived in Iceland for a year and relocated to Atlanta. I was in Atlanta for 2 years. And I was responsible for the global sales and marketing team for CCP. There's about 36, 38 people on that team. We did everything from develop the video trailers that you see to the websites, to the banner advertising campaigns, to the press releases. We managed the community team, and we did a lot of research and development on positioning and brand management and figuring out the key drivers of both EVE and World of Darkness. And last November, I left CCP, and I'm out on my own now. I'm working on a project which isn't announced yet. We are building a plan to develop a fantasy sandbox MMO based on a successful hobby gaming property. And we're about to start raising money for that project. And as a part of that fundraising effort, we'll be making some more detailed announcements about what the project is. But until we're really ready to go out and talk to people about funds, we're not able or willing to discuss the details of what that brand is quite yet.
And I got some questions for you about that. But one thing I do want to draw people's attention to is that in the interim, you are currently writing a series of columns for EN World.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Okay. And if anyone is interested in checking those out, then I will be sure to provide what links I can in the show notes. If you want to see what Ryan's doing publicly in the interim as he works this other job he can't talk about too much, then this would be a place where you can see what kind of stuff he's got to say about the gaming industry. But with this MMO coming up, I am curious because there's an adjective you use in there that has a somewhat fuzzy definition. What exactly do you mean by a sandbox MMO?
My opinion, which is shared by most people at CCP and a fairly significant portion of the MMO design community, is that there's two kinds of MMOs that can be made for a role-playing game. There's obviously MMOs for sports and shooters and things which don't necessarily apply. So this is really within the domain of role-playing. The first of those is called a theme park. And World of Warcraft is a theme park, EverQuest is a theme park. Almost all of the successful MMOs that are in the market today are theme parks. And the distinguishing characteristic of theme park is that the interaction that the player has is primarily with the environment. The player is expected to go through a series of pre-scripted adventures, often more than once. The environment is typically not persistent. The things the player does don't actually have any effect that's noticeable after the player has done them, other than in a few special cases or in certain kind of clever mechanical things where you move forward in the game world and you can't ever go back, so you don't know that what you did behind isn't actually a change.
Instancing, you mean?
I think you're talking about phasing.
Like where in WoW you'll save the mountain and then for you it'll look like it's clean again, but it still looks like crap. Okay.
Yeah, right. I think that's called phasing in WoW.
Okay.
And the beauty of a theme park design is that it's write once and read many. So the development team creates the theme park content, and then the players play it over and over and over again. And as the development team continues to build new content, the amount of content that's in the game just goes up and up and up and up. I attended a great lecture that was given by one of the lead designers of World of Warcraft at the Game Developers Conference a couple of years ago. And he talked about how difficult it is for fantasy theme park MMOs to compete with World of Warcraft because they don't get to compete with World of Warcraft in the state that it was in on the day that it launched. They have to compete with it today after it's been in production for 5 years. And the World of Warcraft that you get today has a tremendous amount of content that has just been added to it as the game has been in a live condition, as it's been active and accepting subscriptions.
Yeah, almost 7 years now post release additions and cleanup. And I was there in beta. I remember it was like at release. And a lot of the things that people excoriate the MMOs that have come after it for, things like Warhammer Online, Age of Conan, et cetera, were all equally true of WoW at release.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so that's one fork of the MMO world. The other fork is what we call sandbox MMOs. And sandbox MMOs are identified primarily by the fact that the player's primary mode of interaction is with other players. The sandbox MMO may provide some theme park content, but its purpose is usually to either act as a tutorial or it's to generate resources that are used elsewhere in the game for other purposes. Eve is the biggest and most successful sandbox MMO. And while it does have some theme park content, the primary mode of interaction in Eve is a player versus player conflict. And whether that's ship on ship fleet fights or it's market-based combat where people are actually buying and selling and trying to change effective prices of things to undermine the economics of their opponents, or political interaction where they're trying to sway large groups of people to switch alliances and actually pick up and move their resources to different areas of space. But by far the primary mechanism through which the game is interesting to players is the player, not really on, but player with other player connections. So,
and Ponzi schemes.
And the other thing that's usually very common in a sandbox environment is that the world is persistent. And when you make changes in the world, those changes remain and are usually visible to all the other players. So in Eve, for example, if you destroy a starbase, that starbase is destroyed for everybody. It's not just a quest where you get told to blow it up and then you come back 6 hours later and it's right back where it started. That's not how it works. Other than some limited theme park content, which is primarily, like I said, just used either as tutorials or to drive resources, things in Eve are persistent. When you build them, they stay built. And when you blow them up, they stay blowed up.
When the Goon Squad took Band of Brothers apart, Band of Brothers remained disassembled.
Delve is Goon.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Although, you know, the interesting story there is that the Goons really showed both CCP and the Eve players in general that the game really is about players, not about stuff.
Yeah.
The Band of Brothers, who are one of the oldest and most sophisticated alliances in Eve, had access to probably the best, most economically rich area of space. They had a lot of resources. They had a lot of ships. They had a very good logistics system. And their pilots were excellent. They were well drilled. They knew how to fight as a group. And the Goons showed up. The Goons are an offspring of a web forum called Something Awful. And the Goons take joy in making the experience of playing online games horrible for other people.
We enrich it for other people. Thank you.
Yeah, John was part of the Goon Squad.
I was in Goon Squad when we were in Delve as it crashed.
Their stated goal is to break the games that they play. And it turned out that they didn't break Eve. Eve broke them.
Yes, because
what they did was they discovered that having a lot of people who are just really willing to just play the game works really well as a strategy. And over time, they became probably the second most powerful alliance in Eve, second only to Band of Brothers. And then there were some internal shakeups inside Band of Brothers, and the Goons were able to take advantage of that and crush them. But the story goes on, because after the Goons moved into the territory that was left vacant when the Band of Brothers was destroyed, the Band of Brothers went off, reformed themselves, and they came back and kicked the Goons out of that space. And the Goons had their own internal problems, and they kind of fell apart.
Yeah, they had a
so there's this
director.
Really interesting dynamic where the relationship between people is way more important than who has the biggest ships or the most guns.
So the goal here with this fantasy MMO is to create something like that, except with swords and sorcery instead of starships and starbases. Is that basically the just? I have a ton of really detailed questions, but I'm sure these are things that probably have not even been decided, much less reached the point of being releasable information. But
we're definitely pitching the product as a fantasy sandbox MMO, but it's going to have some very interesting theme park components. Unlike Eve, a science fiction MMO, where there's just not a really good way to tell interesting scripted stories. The fantasy milieu does have great ways to tell interesting scripted stories. So in addition to all the cool sandboxiness of the game, the players are going to have the opportunity to do things like go run an adventure module, where it will be a more scripted theme park type experience. But all the gear they carry and all the resources that they consume are going to be things that are generated in the sandbox. So there's going to be this really interesting dynamic where some of the players are going to be all about kingdom building and resource development and manufacturing. And some of the players are going to be adventurers, and they're going to be equipped and given stuff to go kill monsters and bring treasure back so the community can grow and thrive. And so it's going to be a really interesting mix of kind of a classic sandbox approach and a more modern kind of hybridized experience.
Hey, Ryan, I want to jump in here real quick and actually jump back on part of your resume, going back to when you launched 3E, only because I have to pay you a compliment on that. I was there for the launch party, and I remember being that, and I got invited to like the special party that was held afterwards.
Specials in like helmets and
no special was in like as in like one of a kind swag that they were handing out for 3E, and I've got to say that the shot glass for that was probably the best promotional related items that I've ever seen, and I'm saddened by the fact that mine broke, but it broke under good circumstances because I was totally face when it happened,
yeah.
Trying to pour myself a shot. But the shot glass for
you went all the way up to Chaotic Evil.
Well, I think in the evening, I think I had poured up to Chaotic. But for those of you who don't know, this basically was like a double height shot glass.
I think it was just Chaotic Irish.
And it had three. That's very true. It had three lines on there: a low line, mid line, and upper line. And on each line, the bottom line was lawful, the middle line was neutral, and the topmost line was chaotic. And, of course, you'd pour your shot depending upon how, you know, you felt at that time. And it was, I mean, gorgeous-looking shot glass, nice glass, but it fell from too great of a height and broke, sadly. But that was probably one of the best items I think I've ever seen.
I have my original shirt from the big announcement. I sealed it with a seal-a-meal, and it's sitting in my archive.
Nice.
It'd be more interesting if you said you were still wearing it to this day.
Yeah.
There actually is something else, though, in that 3E conversation that I wanted to talk about, which is something you mentioned, the open gaming license, the OGL. What I want to talk about is the fact that the OGL, in terms of market penetration, number of products, and units sold, especially in the case of Pathfinder, is still eclipsing 4E.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I don't have numbers to confirm that, but I have reasonable anecdotal data that says that's true.
What's your comment on that?
In some ways, I'm not surprised, and in some ways, I'm stunned.
Okay.
In the beginning, I was actually very concerned that there would be almost no commercial adoption of the open gaming license. One of my biggest fears, in fact, was that it was going to be primarily used by fans to create modules or monsters or conversions of older products that they didn't have access to in third edition. And I was very concerned that the industry was not going to see it as an opportunity. And the reason is that at the time, there were a number of people who were extremely skeptical that Wizards of the Coast was honest about the purposes of the project. And it was a very common thread to see in message boards and to hear at conventions that the real purpose of the open gaming license was to trap all of Wizards' competitors and then yank the license out from under them and destroy all the competition. And so I created this entity called the Open Gaming Foundation, partially because I wanted to have some separation between Wizards of the Coast and the open gaming concept. And there were two mailing lists. There was one that was for the open gaming license in particular, and then there's one that was for the D20 system, both the trademark license and the D20 system reference document. It was on those lists that I did a lot of proselytizing, trying to explain to people that in actual fact, it would be great for Wizards of the Coast if they were to take this license and this material and use it to make game products. Because we believed, I still believe, I suspect that some people at Wizards of the Coast have changed their opinion, but I don't know that for a fact, that it was a case of rising tides lifting all boats, but lifting the biggest boat more. So that the effect would be, if a whole lot of people started using the game mechanic that was in the current version of Dungeons & Dragons, the benefit would be that a lot more copies of the Dungeons & Dragons core rulebooks would be sold than would otherwise have been sold.
It's and like this, the OS.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. If you look across the technology fields today, the objective that everybody has is to create a platform. And, you know, Apple has kind of a walled garden platform where you have to kind of play by their rules or they won't let you in. But Android is a very open platform where it's relatively easy to do anything you want to do. And Google doesn't exert the kind of authority and control that Apple does. And Microsoft, of course, is the granddaddy of all platforms. The Windows Office combo basically defined the computer business for close to 20 years. So having access to a platform and creating a platform and being at the center of the platform is tremendous economic value for whomever creates it. But because there was all this suspicion and all these people that were worried that this was all some grand scheme to somehow destroy the hobby gaming industry, I was really worried that there wasn't going to be a lot of commercial support.
Which is odd, because my waking nightmare in your shoes would have been somebody updating Spelljammer into third edition.
Yeah, but you know, so what, right? I mean, it didn't sell the first time around. Why would it sell somebody updated to third edition? Right? I mean that's really the case for all of that stuff. Yes, there's a small population of people out there who love Spelljammer. And you know what? The open gaming license gives them a chance to keep that thing alive and keep making content for it, and more power to them. That's awesome. But if there was an actual commercial value there, TSR would have extracted it. They wouldn't have abandoned the campaign setting. you know, they kept Forgotten Realms because it made a lot of money. They kept Dragonlance because it made a lot of money. They keep kind of going back to the well with Dark Sun because it made money for a while and they'd like to figure out how to do it again. You know, but it's not a situation where Wizards was afraid that somebody was going to use old first or second edition content to compete with them, because Wizards already had that stuff. If it was useful to compete with it, Wizards would be competing with it. So anyway, to kind of close the loop, one of the very first things that happened commercially with the Open Gaming License is that the guys at Necromancer worked with the folks at White Wolf to create a monster manual, creature collection. And they actually got their monster manual published before the third edition monster manual was on shelves. And they sent me a couple copies of the book. And I tell you, I walked around the halls of Wizards like a proud papa. If I'd had cigars to hand out, I would have done it. I was so pleased that people had seen the commercial advantage to doing this, that really a top tier, probably the top tier company besides Wizards of the Coast in the role-playing game segment was involved in making an Omen gaming product, completely validated it, I think, in the minds of most of the rest of the industry. And well, after and that
Atlas,
happened...
Atlas Games was that yep. way too. I remember in the release, yep. they had First Adventure there yep. that day, the day 3E got released. They yep. had it in their yep. booth as well.
Death yep, and Freeport.
They had 3 Days to Kill. Baby? And Green yep. Ronin had, I think they had Freeport or a Freeport related product.
Oh, was that Green
product.
Ronin? Yeah, yeah.
Ready to go, yeah.
That came out the day.
Not taking anything away from the guys at Green Ronin or Atlas. Those are relatively small companies, right? White Wolf is the second biggest role-playing game publisher in the world. And when they did an open gaming product, that was a stamp of approval. That was them saying, hey, if we thought this was a way to get screwed, we wouldn't touch this with a 10-foot pole. We just think this is a way to make a lot of money. Which it was, right? Nobody got screwed. And people did make a lot of money. Okay, so now we fast forward. It's been 10 years, 11 years. And, you know, the question is, why is that momentum still there? Why is a game like Pathfinder still being successful? And, you know, my answer is that the market tends to choose to play games that people are familiar with. And I said from the very beginning that one of the things that Open Gaming was going to do to Dungeons & Dragons was make it very difficult to make a version of D&D that wasn't reasonably backwards compatible with 3rd edition. And 3rd edition is reasonably backwards compatible with 2nd, and 2nd is reasonably backwards compatible with 1st. Now, I will be utterly honest. I have not played enough 4th edition to have a technical opinion about compatibility. I haven't had the time and I haven't had the interest. So it may be that 4th edition is reasonably backwardly compatible with 3rd edition.
In my opinion,
I just don't know.
It's quite different.
Yeah, that's kind of my opinion as well. It's not a very well-formed opinion, and so I hate to bandy it about, but it looks different enough that I think it created a sense of discontinuity. Yeah. Okay, so in the past, there was no other option, right? When TSR went to 2nd edition, they just stopped printing 1st edition. And you were out of luck. If you wanted new 1st edition materials, you had to write it yourself. And if you tried to sell what you wrote, you were probably going to get sued. With 4th edition, Wizards doesn't have that luxury. There is going to be something that looks like 3rd edition of Dungeons & Dragons commercially produced forever. And they're not able to just turn off that spigot and kind of force a switch to the new system. They have to win in the marketplace. They have to make a product that people feel is superior enough to subject themselves and their gaming group to the challenges of switching game systems. And it doesn't appear to me that they did that. Now, I could be totally wrong. And it could be that there's just a lot more people playing in 4th edition than I know of, because I just don't have access to the data that I used to have. But I see things like the titles coming off the shelves in bookstores. And I see things like products being cut from the future release list. And I see things like the difference in the number of people who are playing 4th edition RPGA scenarios versus Pathfinder Society adventures. And all that anecdotal data leads me to conclude that the branch of the tree that is 3rd edition, 3.5, and Pathfinder is currently healthier and stronger than the branch of the tree that is 4th edition.
That is also my assessment from the same anecdotal reasons. And it's why I'm developing an OGL game. It's just a good system. It's one that everyone's comfortable with. And frankly, it's a better system than 4.
In fact, you know, the Open Gaming License is not D20. But the nature of the Open Gaming License is that anything that is published using the Open Gaming License is interchangeable. And there is some amazing stuff out there that is licensed with the Open Gaming License. The Fudge system is licensed with the Open Gaming License. There were two really significant derivative D20 games, the Spycraft 2.0, which is awesome. And there's something else. I'm trying to remember what it was. Anyway, there's at least another product out there that's just spectacularly good, deviating a lot from core design ideas of 3rd edition. And as a publisher or as a consumer, you can mix and match that stuff to any degree that you want when you make a product, because it's all licensed with the exact same terms.
Ryan, the first time we had you on the show, this is about 4 years ago now, I didn't check the dates on it before recording this. I'm just going to wildly assume it was about 4 years ago. The thing that we had you on to talk about was predictions that you had regarding the RPG industry. I guess these would have been predictions that you made back in, probably 2006, maybe 2007. Yeah. And I am curious about two things. One, how do you feel you've done with your past predictions? And I don't have them in front of me, so I'm not actually going to go down here checking you off and scoring you. But just in general, how do you feel you've done with your past predictions? And secondly, what are your predictions right now for the future of tabletop gaming, with a specific emphasis on role-playing games over card games and board games?
Okay. In general, I would say that my predictions were well-founded. There were a couple that didn't come to pass, primarily due to changes in the marketplace. There were a couple that didn't come to pass at all. There are some that came to pass that just took much longer than I expected. And there are some that happened right on schedule. In fact, my friend Luke Peterschmidt, at the time that I did my last round of predictions, he basically said that he agreed with everything I said. I was just 3 years too early. And in some cases, he was right about that. He's in some cases more optimistic than I am and more pessimistic than I am. There were some very important things happening in that time frame, that kind of 2006, 2007 time frame, that are still affecting us today, but definitely had a big effect over the last 4 or 5 years. The biggest change is that the industry as a whole got a lot smaller. There are a lot of publishers that are either out of the business. They don't publish hobby gaming titles anymore. They don't publish them as their primary line of business anymore. Or they've become a small 1 or 2 person company that basically produces whatever the owner writes. But they're not really a going concern in the sense that they're hiring additional staff and creating a living wage for a whole team of people, which was kind of where the industry was before that period. There were also a lot of shakeups in the distribution channel. One of the things that happens as a result of the kind of contraction in the industry is that the number of retailers reduced substantially, and that undermined the business model of a lot of the distributors. And the distributors had to either consolidate, change their business models, or go out of business as well. And that actually has upstream effects on the publishers as well. One of the things that a lot of people don't really realize is that most distributors order more copies of a book than they sell. The extra copies that sit on distributor warehouses are cash flow that goes upstream to the publishers. And as the number of distributors goes down, or as the distributors get much more aggressive on reducing the size of the buys they make, those product overages go away. And so does the profit and revenue that comes with them. So this contraction is a multi-stage, multi-impact process that affects all of the tiers of the industry negatively. So the question was, is it going to get so bad that it'll go into a runaway feedback loop and it won't be able to stop itself? In other words, will the conditions arise under which the death of retail stores kills the distributors, which hurts the publishers so badly that they can't stay in business to service the retailers that are left, which kills the rest of the retailers, which destroys the whole business model? And that does not appear to have happened, fortunately. But part of what has happened in the interim is that a whole lot of those retailers have figured out how to make money selling things other than hobby gaming products, which is good. It's a way to maintain a retail channel, even if the retail channel all by itself is no longer commercially viable. And that's a transition that's pretty painful. And, I watched a lot of retailers that I've known for a long time leave the business because they either didn't want to do that or they couldn't figure out how to make it work. And that's unfortunate. The industry lost a lot of knowledge in that process about how to retail the games that we publish. And it may be irreplaceably lost at this point. Now we have to find all new ways to sell our products online, PDF, digital downloads. That's a new and growing segment of the market. So we get to innovate on that side while we're kind of trying to hold the line on the old brick and mortar retail side. And then on the publisher side, WizKids is gone and then they're back, but they're kind of back in a weird way. And it remains to be seen whether the backness is going to stick. You know, they were basically not publishing there for a couple of years after Pops was acquired by Michael Eisner and WizKids shut itself down. White Wolf is focusing the majority of its attention on publishing an MMO. The people that are still involved in producing tabletop role-playing game product are doing it primarily as a labor of love or as a way to provide some fan support during this long period of development while they're waiting to get the computer game up and running. But in no sense is it the business of White Wolf anymore to be a hobby gaming publisher. And there's a bunch of smaller companies in the middle that are either gone or it's hard to say what they do anymore. You know, what does Chaosium do anymore? They keep books in print. Maybe they publish a book once in a while, but they don't act like a publishing company used to act 10 years ago. So So that, those are all pretty dramatic changes. Upper Deck, at the time I made those predictions, was a gigantic colossus in the field. They had the Yu-Gi-Oh! License. They were actively licensing other properties. They had built up a very substantial team of designers. They had an ongoing effort to develop a role-playing game system, and the role-playing game system never shipped. Upper Deck lost the Yu-Gi-Oh! License, and Upper Deck is essentially gone as a hobby gaming publisher. They don't publish anything that's meaningful anymore, and they vanished. Games Workshop had a near-death experience. I was actually involved for several years in an effort trying to lead a private equity buyout of Games Workshop. We thought they were monstrously undervalued, and they had huge problems operationally. They went through a series of layoffs and executive restructurings. The CEO left. They issued some profit warnings. Their stock price took a huge battering. But they seem to have gotten the ship righted over there. And lately, they're making pretty good strides. And what they're doing is kind of what we would have done if we'd been able to buy that company. They're focusing on their core business. They're doing a really good job about making metal and plastic miniatures and doing it efficiently, dealing with rising commodity prices and the changes in the retail channel and all that other stuff. So I think if you were to go back and parse everything I wrote, you know, you would probably say on the strictest sense of things, I was probably 30% absolutely correct. 30% of the things that I suggested eventually came to pass, and 30% either didn't happen or are so different that not happening became immaterial.
That's not bad, though. You'd be a superstar in baseball.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding. If all these companies were publicly traded, I'd be a millionaire.
Let's talk about Gen Con this year.
Yeah.
There were some observations that I made while walking around the convention, and I want to spin my theories on why those things were occurring. And I'm curious whether you agree with me, disagree with me, or what your thinking is. Because as you said prior to us recording, right now you and I sit in about the same boat where we're two individuals walking around. Obviously, your insider knowledge of the industry goes back farther and deeper than mine does. But nonetheless, we're two people basically walking around making educated guesses based on things we see and maybe little grapevine tidbits we get. But neither of us is actively employed by, you know, one of the big giants looking at stacks of market data. So here's the first one that I want to throw out. When I walked around the dealer hall, outside of noticing it was in a really inconvenient location this year,
yeah,
one of the things that I have noticed as a trend over the past couple years that continued this year is a receding portion of the dealer hall is taken up by tabletop role-playing game companies. Oh, yeah. And those that are present tend to be present in very low-key ways. I mean, there was a few of them there that had really big displays, Catalyst being an example. But many of them that were there, Arc Dream being an example, IPR being another example, White Wolf was all but absent. But many of these guys were either very low-key, small booths, a few of them not present at all. Even some of the companies that I thought should have been there in really big displays, once again, very small, not there at all. As card games, board games, and even children's games take up an increasing percentage of the hall. However, let me contrast this with another observation. When I left the dealer hall and actually walked around the gaming rooms, the open gaming areas, saw what people were reading, saw what people were playing, I saw a tremendous percentage of them playing role-playing products. Now, my theory on this is that because of the changes you talked about in publishing, and particularly because of the rise of things like electronic publishing, and because of the decentralization of game production made so easy by the internet, by things like the OGL, that what has happened is that top tier of game publishers who relied on that old business model are mostly in recession. And what is happening, however, to balance that is there is a rapidly expanding second and third tier of game publishers who are putting out a lot of content, in some cases a lot of great content, but don't do enough in terms of volume to warrant a massive four-booth setup at Gen Con. And I'm curious if you agree with that observation.
I agree with it. I don't necessarily know if my analysis is the same. Let me take it from the top. So your observation about what was happening in the vendors hall, I completely agree with. I made the observation, and I heard the observation made to me by several people, that Gen Con is rapidly becoming a board gaming show. The interesting thing about that is my friends in the industry are telling me that the board gaming section is so segmented and so saturated that it's very difficult to make any money in that anymore. So it may be that we're going to see a big upheaval now of people who have overinvested in board gaming inventory struggling with a cash flow problem.
Definitely see saturated. Because unlike an RPG, a board game is a much more finite product. There's only so many ways to play it, so many times to play it. It's very product-oriented, not as imagination-oriented. And there are a ton of companies wading into that market with a ton of products.
And they have a huge inventory overhead. The overhead to produce even a hardbound role-playing game book is trivial compared to a multi-component, substantial box hobby board gaming product. And yeah, the prices are a lot higher. You know, Fantasy Flight charges a nice bit of coin for some of those boxes that they produce. But the farther you go down the food chain, the harder it is to support that inventory if you're a small company. So I think that's a danger. I think it's a concern. If I was in that business, I would be very leery of making board game investments right now. You know, and there's this whole wave of games that followed along behind Dominion, these deck building games. And it seems like everybody is kind of exploring that niche almost to the point of saturation as well. Those games are a lot less expensive to produce, but there's still a lot of cost tied up in those components, and they're still going to take up a lot of space and inventory. So that may be a thing to look at in the next couple of years, is how that segment of the industry learns to operate in an environment where they have a lot of competitors. It's definitely not like it used to be, where there's Rio Grande and Mayfair and maybe one or two other companies. Now it's almost every significant publisher has some kind of fairly substantial board game line. There's a lot of product out there. Okay, so let me talk about the role-playing game thing a little bit. I'm a big fan of The Burning Wheel and of Luke Crane, who's the guy who publishes and designed The Burning Wheel. What I'm about to say, I want to say in that context, that I really like the product. I actually believe that if we lived in a different era, that Luke would have been one of the people in that same line of entrepreneur slash game designers that includes, you know, Gary Gygax and Steve Jobs and Kevin Sambita and Peter Atkinson, a guy who was able to leverage his talent into creating a company. Unfortunately, I don't think that's possible anymore. The support I would give to that conclusion is Luke has just announced that he is doing a new version of the Burning Wheel, Burning Wheel Gold, and he's retiring the previous version, which sold 8,000 copies in 5 years. That is a stunningly small number, and I believe that is the best-selling independent RPG on the market. Everybody else sold less than him. He had probably the number one sales. And if that's the size of that market segment, that is just not commercially sustainable in anything other than a model where one or two people are a company. And they can't grow because companies that small, they can't get far enough ahead to generate the capital they need to take risk and invest in things that may or may not pay off. So there's probably going to be a lot of products like The Burning Wheel, one or two book games, really high production qualities, really well written, just loved to death. But there won't be these Palladium-style, TSR-style, White Wolf-style companies that produce a whole range of products, all based on the same game system, all based on the same IP. I just don't see the business as big enough to support that. And so when you walk around Gen Con and you see people playing a lot of role-playing games, unfortunately, one of the things I would say is you may be looking at most of the people who play role-playing games in the whole country. It may be that the communities become so small that they all just come to Gen Con. And so, yeah, there's a lot of people at that show playing role-playing games, but when they go home, how many people are left to play with them? And that's a question that nobody has an answer to. There's no data either way about the number of people who are currently involved in regularly playing a tabletop role-playing game. But my gut instinct tells me that number is much smaller than it was 10 years ago, and it's probably getting smaller every day.
If that's the case, and going on the assumption that you aren't the only one who has that gut feeling, wouldn't it make sense to make some sort of initiative or to begin something to try to either turn that trend around or at least stop that trend? I mean, you know, some sort of evangelical initiative to recruit new players. Because I do agree, for all the years that I've gone to Gen Con, it does seem to me that it is somewhat aging. Now, you know, of course, I mean, obviously you're still going to see a good percentage of young people there. But on the whole, it does appear to me to also be an aging crowd.
Actually, Chris, I wish you had been there this year. My observation this year was the exact reverse. You would not believe how young the population was. But we'll come back to demographics in
that. I want to actually slice those into two different buckets because they're two different questions.
I agree, because demographics is a whole new ballgame.
The point you made, which is why isn't there some crusade to save role-playing? My answer to that is why? Why should there be a crusade to save role-playing? There's no intrinsic need for that thing to exist unless customers want it. And customers are getting a good portion of what they used to get out of their tabletop role-playing game experience in MMOs. And the MMO environment is getting better and better and better, not worse and worse and worse.
But there in your statement, I think, lies the answer. You're saying they're getting most of. And I think that that what they're missing is the reason why I would say, yes, you should say that, because I think a lot of people don't know what they're missing. You have someone who has never done a tabletop RPG before. And I'll give you a good example of this. They've played MMOs. They played Oblivion. They've done that kind of stuff. They have that perspective of what it's like. But I sat down with my son and a couple of his friends just a few weeks ago, and two of them were brand new players. They'd never done tabletop RPG before.
Sure.
And the look on their faces when I told them that, no, you can talk to this guy. You can ask him more than three questions, and you're going to get more than just three rote answers. You can talk to him about whatever the hell you want. Yep. And if you want to go there instead of there, go ahead. I'll give you hints where you might want to go, but it doesn't matter. You can go wherever you want to go. And then the look on his face and the realization that, oh my gosh, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And to me, spoke volumes as to why it should be saved.
Well, I guess my response to that is that there is a multi-billion-dollar industry staffed with tens of thousands of the brightest people on the planet who are trying to make that experience happen in an online environment, and they are going to succeed. So you're basically in a race with parity. And after parity is achieved, it'll just get better than tabletop games. There won't be anything you can do on a tabletop that is better than what you can do in an online environment.
And I do agree that in that perspective, you know, I'm not an idiot. I do see that is something that is eventually going to happen. No doubt about it.
The other corollary to what I would say is, and I think we're going to talk about this later in the discussion, is part of what we need to do as hobbyists who like this particular art form is we have to try to make it more accessible to a larger audience.
Yes.
And just like a lot of art forms that have gone down this path in the past, and I would point at things like jazz music, for example, that became so complicated and so complex and hard to understand that they lost their mass audience, the role-playing game industry has kind of done the same thing. We have created amazing products that are almost impossible to use unless you're willing to dedicate unbelievably large amounts of time and attention to play them. And the people that you're talking about, kids your son's age, they're never going to do that. They have many other things to do with their time. So we've got to kind of refactor the role-playing game concept in a way that makes sense for people to play more easily and with more accessibility than the games that we're currently playing.
This is about a year ago when my son and one of his other friends sat down and we did some 3-5. To get them to even look at the rule book was an impossible task. I could get them to thumb through it, but were they going to read it? Oh, no. No way.
Yeah. I tell Lisa that the scariest thing about Pathfinder is the book.
That's a big damn
book. It's like 580 pages long.
It's a book. It's good looking. Even someone like who's been doing this for years, I look at that and I'm like, when am I going to have the time to honestly look at this?
Yeah. Really? I mean, my heart says this product is awesome, but my head tells me that no one will ever play it because it's nobody who's not currently playing will ever play it because it's just too intimidating.
I also look at it in terms of like video games. The first time I picked up Civilization, it had an encyclopedia of a rule book, and I'm talking about the video game here, not the board game. I had to read it. You could not play that game unless either A, somebody taught you, or B, you read that rule book.
Try playing Dwarf Fortress.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And it is now at a point where I go out by an Xbox game, I sit down, and I start playing it. I only touched the instruction manual maybe after several sittings in the game when my wife is curious, because she likes watching me play story-driven RPGs, and she's curious if the voice actor for so-and-so is the same as so-and-so from another game because they sound similar.
Right. And looking at the credits, not the rules.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're flipping right past everything to the credits. And I see what you're saying. I guess to use an analogy that I've used in several other environments before, this is an idea that is intellectually simple and emotionally difficult. The idea that our art form is struggling because of the fact that its very foundation is no longer of interest to a broad consumer market is real easy to grasp. But the idea of a world that isn't dominated by TSR and FASA and et cetera, for tabletop social entertainment, to me, on an emotional, personal level, is a somewhat distressing idea. I mean, don't get me wrong. The books on my shelf, presupposing no house fire here, aren't going anywhere. I can be 60 years old and still playing these games. It doesn't matter what version of Xbox or PlayStation or whatever is out by then.
No, there's still jazz
the operating
music.
System is in your head.
Yeah, exactly. As John said, there's still jazz music. Yeah. But to hell if you're going to sell tickets to a jazz concert that you do to Taylor Swift.
Tough to do.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me take a sidetrack now. Let's talk a little bit about the demographics I saw at Gen Con. And I completely agree with you. They were younger and they were more female. than they have been in a long time. And I think there's a reason for that. And I think the reason for that is PAX. So PAX is one of those things that many people who are active in the hobby gaming industry just really don't get. They didn't pay much attention to it, and they don't really understand it, and it's really not their thing. And it kind of happened without them, and so they don't notice it. It actually reminds me a lot of the conversations you and I used to have about podcasting and how the whole industry just kind of missed it. Like, they were all over the web, and they were all over news groups, and they just missed the podcasting thing for several years. They finally figured it out, but it surely took them a long time to figure it out. PAX is gigantic. The PAX in Seattle, PAX Prime, draws about, I think it's 50,000 people. And the second PAX, PAX East, sold out 70,000 people. And they had an estimated 20,000 people more who tried to buy tickets before they could get all the stuff configured to let them know they couldn't get tickets.
Wow. And that happened in less than 5 years.
Yes, it's overnight. Okay.
Yeah. No corporate sponsorship.
So what's going on with PAX? If you look at the people at PAX, they are a totally different crowd than the people who come to the traditional hobby gaming events, to Origins or Gen Con. They're younger. They're gender balanced. They're interested in things beyond their games. Gaming to them is a cultural thing, not a hobby. So there's bands that are associated with games, and there's fashion associated with games, and there's romance and lifestyle choices associated with games. Gaming is who they are as people, not what they do as a recreation.
See, and you approach it from a different angle, but actually my reasoning pretty much ends up in the same place. There's something that we have observed on this show, because even here we have represented two or three decades of age difference.
Yep.
And one of the things that we noticed is the things that made you a total outcast nerd, get your ass kicked and stuffed in a locker for anyone who's 35 and up, is what the cool kids are doing for 30 and down.
Fellowship of the Ring, the film, came out when I was 16. It was immediately cool. And having read Tolkien 10 times in grade school made me a rock star.
I mean, I remember that in my day, and I'm not that old, I'm 34 years old, you did not admit to playing video games on a computer. Maybe a Nintendo or an Atari, but you did not admit to playing video games on a computer.
Yeah.
Now that is what people do.
Yeah.
And in the same way, I see that spilling over into the realm of tabletop gaming.
Yeah, if we didn't play Pokemon when I was 13, we were losers.
Over 100,000 people, if you put the two packs together and assume there's some overlap, over 100,000 people went to a show, saw a lot of other people just like them, and said, this is awesome. I want to do more of this. When's the next one? And what were they told? You should go to Gen Con. And they did. Some fraction of that 100,000 people went to Indianapolis this year. And you know what? They had a pretty good time. This was a good Gen Con. There was a little bit of problem with registration, but not much. But other than that, it was a good show. There was lots of gaming. There was lots of camaraderie. There wasn't any big thing going on in the industry. There wasn't any big negative thing happening in the world. I saw a lot of happy gamers at Gen Con. And I bet it's going to rebound next year. They're going to tell their friends they had a good time at Gen Con, and they're going to bring their friends. And so I think this is all really positive.
Here's my question for you, where we stray from educated guessing into wild conjecture. Do you think that younger audience coming in, if it is capitalized upon correctly, could represent a second wind for tabletop role playing?
Okay, so my answer is yes and no. My answer is yes, in that I think that there's absolutely a population of gamers who could be introduced into role playing, and they might find it to be a worthwhile addition to the list of games that they play. The difference is that they are not going to spend $2,000 a year on their hobby, which is what most really hardcore hobby game hobbyists spend. They're going to spend $30 here and $40 there, and that's it. They're used to monetizing things much smaller than hardcore traditional hobby game players are. So those are the people that are going to buy a book, the core book. They are not going to buy 27 supplements.
I agree with that. I think that that's true, that they'll get the bare minimum and then just go off that and be happy with that until the new shiny comes along because of their attention spans, and then move on to that.
And they're not going to play it every Friday for 6 hours for the next 10 years. They're going to play it maybe a half dozen times. They're going to maybe do a complete adventure experience. And when it's done, it'll go on the shelf with the other 2,000.
It'll be done in spurt between major Xbox releases.
Yeah. Well, I just think it'll be done more casually. It'll be done more like, you know, hey, we're all going to Bob's house this weekend. Hey, let's do that gaming thing we brought back from Gen Con. Okay, that's fun. And then they do it, right? It's not going to be this thing we have where, like, you know, 10 people organized with chips and pizza, and they come for 6 hours on a special time. And the people that are younger that we saw at Gen Con this year, that is not how they interact with their games. They play lots of different games in small increments.
Do you have anything else? Any bones you're looking to pick? Any any wild conjecture you're looking to get out there?
I was actually stunned at Gen Con this year because there was tremendous buzz in the industry underground by the middle of the afternoon on Friday that there was going to be a very significant announcement by Wizards of the Coast on Saturday morning. And I literally went to bed Friday night thinking I was going to get up and drive into the convention center and I was going to walk in the door and it was going to be pure chaos. And I got there and nothing happened. And it was so weird. Because usually when the industry gets all buzzed up about something, it usually happens. Mostly because we're all good friends with each other and none of us keep a secret. So the fact that it didn't happen is more interesting to me than the fact that there might have been an announcement. Because that means that all kind of weird things are now in play. And I have no idea what the ramifications are, positive or negative. It's unexplored territory. It's just weird and strange, which is interesting and fun.
I noticed the same thing because wandering around trying to see what the big announcements were this year, I talked to several people who went by the WotC booth and were told repeatedly, we have a huge announcement we're going to make, but we can't tell you anything about it.
Yeah.
And then the con ends.
Yeah.
And it was over.
It was done. Yeah.
The Dark Elves won the contest.
Yeah. For a never winner. Right? Yeah. But that was no secret. They were handing that out from the day you walked in.
Yeah.
The
WotC booth was very odd because I wandered by it several times. It's just like, what is this? It's this huge space that they've got. They had one of the bigger booths at Gen Con. It's just wide open, and there are people standing around handing out flyers. Yep. And that was it. And they'd say, well, what do you got going?
Buy power cards.
This big thing that's coming out.
Show this card to your GM, and he has to let your character do this ability. Yeah, see how far that
goes. It was weird. So, I mean, that's, you know, for your listeners out there, you have to understand the hobby gaming industry is a very, very small place. There's probably less than 100 people who are kind of in the industry in a design and business sense. There's a lot more, you do customer service and accounting and things like that. But it's a relatively small group of people. We all know each other pretty well. And so the rumor mill is usually very reliable. And in this case, it was not. And that is what I think is interesting, because it happens so infrequently that the rumor mill is not reliable. So I don't know what to say now. I speculate that there will be a big announcement at some point. I just don't know what it will be and when it will happen.
We failed our innuendo checks. They should have kept it in 3.5. Oh, well.
It was bizarre. Very strange.
All right. Well, Ryan, I want to thank you for joining us. I mean, as previously and also I'd say as always, not that it's always recorded, but I catch up with you every so often at various conventions and stuff.
Yeah.
It's always very interesting talking to you. And we're trying to get Ken Height on here at some point. And
oh, he'll be great.
I'm trying to see if I can get him to phrase it as the Ryan Dancy rebuttal.
Well, you know, if you get Ken on the show, what you want to do is you want to give him three words and tell him to explain to you how they're all connected. And he will spontaneously whip out some of the coolest ideas for a campaign you will ever hear. It will probably involve a Nazi Antarctic base, but it will be awesome.
What do they be? Ogre Mage, Opera House, and Rescuer? Is he the guy behind Iron GM? That's Healy, isn't
it?
No,
that's Healy.
You could probably pick three random words out of a dictionary, and he would give you back something that was
You know what? Funny. You set down that challenge. It may be a month or two before he's on here, but I want to commit to you and to our listeners right now. We are going to do the Ken Height three-word challenge. So I will pick out three words from a dictionary, and we will do the Ken Height three-word challenge.
Right on.
So, Ryan, thank you again for being on here. As for the rest of you guys out there in Bootland, be sure to check the show notes for a variety of links to Ryan's stuff, also to the Blood Moon Goblins Kickstarter.
Be a goblin.
Stay tuned. After Gen Con, I walked away with quite a few folks that we're going to interview, so we got a bunch of interviews coming up, and of course some regular and bonus episodes we're going to mix in between. So you guys have a great week and wonderful games, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
Later, Dave.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.